This is Daniels from Majority Rights Radio. To quote our guest, Anthony Mickles, from the conclusion of his article, The Difference Between Debt-Free Money and Interest-Free Credit, quote, current debt-free proposals do not comprehensively solve usury and thus also not money scarcity. However, debt-free money can be decisively improved both by interest-free banking and demurrage. There is no tutor-like practice, and ultimately, we will have to experiment with different systems to know which is best. The best part of the story is that we have several ways of solving our monetary problems overnight. Only the knowledge and the will are lacking as yet, and this is changing too, unquote. I view this as potentially a critical moment in the advance of native European white nationalist interests. Here we are beginning to discuss a most crucial means to achieve sovereignty from Jewish and other non-white imposition, along with a freedom from traitorous influences. This is an independence to be achieved in large measure through economic independence of European peoples and nations. It is also an important discussion in particular as it furthers the path of pursuing European interests Jew-wise, but unlike so many sites so badly misrepresenting white nationalism by insisting upon including the resurrection of Hitler and his image. By proceeding in contrast through our own lights, not by Hitler's book of rules, we may pursue systemizations which, while in some instances similar in some of the more benign and beneficial ideas that NS Germany used, we can use these ideas free of Hitler, the necessary aversion, insult, and repugnance, the violent divisiveness of whites that he will create, positions which we need not comport for the sake of some sort of absurd unanimity to all things Hitler, as if his thinking was flawless and he had it all figured out such that no new thinking need apply. Some of these kids out there want to blame the post-war generation for everything, to say that Hitler had it all right. Well, no, he didn't, and it is exactly because he was such a tactless, over-the-top elitist fool that he made the racial advocacy that you want to blame us for not standing by impossible, much as we may have wanted and tried. Hitler's program aside, then, we do seek to take the crucial step toward the sovereignty of native European peoples, connecting now with the fact that economics is a crucial aspect of this sovereignty. I have invited Anthony Mickles to talk with Majority Rights, most curious to learn how his interest-free credit ideas might play into the working out of a sovereign economic system in conjunction with the Euro-DNA nation. Briefly, the Euro-DNA nation is concerned with the protection and reconstruction of mixed Europeans, that is, those having two or more European parentages in their makeup, and pure native European genetic groups. It views this native European DNA as an essential requirement for possible membership in the nation. Fulfilling that requirement, it has its objectives, the sovereignty for our people in regard to our 1, ancient national habitats, 2, deliberately chosen communities within the ancient nations and in diaspora, where some of the economic experiments that Mickles discusses may be conducted, and 3, the sovereignty, economic and otherwise, of our people overall, coordination independent of location. For our larger genus, as necessarily organized in sufficient defense against the antagonism of non-white powers, and for the purpose of sufficient economy for ambitious projects such as space exploration. It is on these crucial matters of discretionary sovereignty for the ancient European nations and the subcategories of our smaller and or deliberately chosen nations, countries, communities, and finally of our overall coordination in sovereignty of the category of people of native European descent in order to maintain the whole genus and the species of native Europeans, that Mickles can begin to help us, particularly to devise and take some critical steps to economic independence and thereby sovereignty proper. Those are my primary concerns, which will perhaps be discussed after GW and Anthony Mickles first bring their own particular concerns into this conversation between them, which begins now.
Thank you very much. I just want to say at the beginning that those primary concerns are the primary concerns in my view. Economics is a primary part of what is wrong at the moment. Economics is a primary part of of the motivation for the forces that are driving globalization, driving our present trajectory towards disaster. And therefore it's important as part of the nationalist oeuvre that we have a grasp, an economic grasp, both of the world as it is and of the kind of transformations that can be effected in it without perhaps as much difficulty as we imagine. And for the latter, we do need to speak to people who are specialized. It's an area where people who think theoretically, people who think philosophically, don't necessarily have an awful lot to say. So as one of those people, I'd very much like to welcome Anthony today to talk to us. I'm most grateful to you for coming to do so, and also for having a world view that is amenable to our own. It's a fine thing to find. I hadn't heard of you before. I don't know where Daniel dug you up from. Perhaps you tell us a little bit about yourself and your own background.
Okay, thank you, GW. I mean, you know, the monetary problem is really very much at the heart of the whole issue because, I'll give you a little bit of my own background, and I think this will give you a picture of how I fit in your own agenda and in your own worldview, because I started waking up politically a little more over 10 years ago, and this started for me with watching a famous film, The Money Masters by Bill Still, and this film makes very clear that beyond the state there is in fact a banking cartel that that rules the world and has the decisive power in the world. And it was from seeing that film that I started to realize that we are actually economic slaves to this banking cartel. And when I recovered from that shock, because before that I was just a normal guy, left-leaning socialist in my late 20s, and basically just one of these hip Westerners. And then I started to realize this whole idea of democracy was just a total hoax. There are no free markets. There is a one huge transnational cartel of banks that basically own everything, and to whom we are indebted, and who own all the land, all the factories, all the industries, all the major markets. And when I recovered from that shock, I really started digging into the monetary system, because if you realize that banks control the world, then you must also realize that you must know how money works, and because that is the tool of enslavement. And the key quote that drives me in my work is this famous Rothschild quote, give me control of a nation's money and I do not care who makes the laws. I mean, everybody knows this quote, whatever, if you're even slightly informed, you know about this quote.
Yes.
And there is a very profound, this is a very profound truth. And they do rule through money, and by controlling money, and with a number of devices, first and foremost usury, and also the boom bust cycle, and also the power they have to allocate credit, so they can decide who can invest in what, which is very important, because people like us, we can go to a bank and the bank will tell us to go elsewhere, and there is nowhere else to go.
Right.
And the bank will only invest in those who they want to control, who they already control, and this gives them total supremacy. And this basic issue that through money they control everything, this is what drives me in my work. And in the years after that, I really started, wondering, of course, what is behind it all, because, okay, you have a banking cartel and you have all this information in the alternative media about the conspiracy, and you start wondering, okay, who is really behind the banking cartel? Is it is it the Jews? Is it the Vatican? Is it the aliens? Is it a satanic conspiracy? And okay, well, you can discuss this at length. My personal point of view at this point is that it is Jewish supremacy, which has been called the Gentile elites, and that we have a number of ancient families, both Jewish money and Gentile aristocracy, and they have intermarried, and it is Jew-dominated, because the Jews are, with the diaspora, they have, and the financial system, are very internationally oriented, and Gentile elites are bound to their own land. And this is what has given the Jews a very important advantage in the struggle for power. This also means that I do not believe that getting rid of the Jews will solve anything, because then we will be saddled with our own so-called elites, which are really no better. These people are also completely obsessed with power and avarice, and that's why they work with the Jews. And so we have to take it all a step further. We have to get rid of the idea that we must have huge national or internationally organized centralized power. We have to have individual rights and decentralized power, where local communities can decide in which way they want to develop as a group. And we have different levels of identity, but we live as individuals, as families, as tribes, as nations, as races, and all these levels we express identity. But I think that it all begins with us being men and women, and well, and mainly the men then, because they are the heads of the household and the heads of the family, and that is where the sovereignty must be.
Okay. You seem to take a fairly hard view, correct me if I'm wrong, of the ways in which this source of power imposes itself on the global agenda. Do you see the globalist effort as being literally an imposition from this very small elite, directly forced upon, or not forced upon, but directly handed down to those below, the water carriers, the executive officers? Or do you see it just emerging out of trends and commercial appetites?
Well, I think these two approaches, so this top-down orders being given, direct orders being given, or a more indirect means of influencing things, I think these things do not bite each other at all. I think that from the central minds that control it all, because I very much believe that there is a centralized hierarchy that has a very clear view of where it is heading, and that is implementing its plans in a very concrete and direct way. But the way that they go about spreading their orders into society, these are all mind control operations. So they create trends, and they create ideas which people then think they have come up with themselves, you know. And these lower ranked lieutenants, or just the masses themselves, they pick up these ideas and trends, and they think that they are expressing themselves, but they are in fact being manipulated into moving into the direction that the central planners have in mind. So I think that this is these two approaches of a top-down hierarchy, or a more subtle way of domination, as you described just yet, are both happening at the same time.
Yeah, I think that they are both happening at the same time. It's really a question of how they impact upon people who are actually effecting globalist policy. If you look at the European Union, for example, the European Union, as we all know, commenced in a desire to prevent another war in Europe, which is a perfectly honourable objective. And you wouldn't have said that it was a globalist tool in that sort of, you know, what was it, Federation, European Federation of Coal, Iron and something or other, Iron and Steel. But now, when you look at the European Union, you would say, well, this is a globalist body. It has people who are at the top in it, political people, who will say outright, and I think Verhofstadt has said this outright, that now is not the time to speak openly about one world government, but of course that remains our eventual aim, and so on. So, you know, you would look at the European Union and say, well, it's quite different now from where it was in its arising, and it seems highly... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, let me respond to that, because that's an excellent example of what we are discussing, because this whole story of let us have peace in Europe and create a union to achieve that, that is exactly how they operate. The idea is we're going to impose with an iron fist the world government all over the place. And the story is, let's have peace. And that's how they manipulate the gullible into cooperating with all this. But obviously, if you have a banking cartel that has been orchestrating European affairs at least since 1815, but even before then also, but in a very direct way from at least the Congress of Vienna, in a very direct way, the banking cartel has been behind all these wars that has been wrecking Europe in the 19th and 20th century. And if you want to have peace, we can just as well send these people to the dark side of the moon, and we don't need this European Union at all.
So you're saying it's also inherent in the system of usury. It's not just a matter of the cartel at the top.
Well, okay, now that's where my work as a monetary reform activist comes in, because the point is that usury is the way with which is centralized wealth and power, and their income through usury, which is unfathomable, which is about trillions per year. I mean, we're talking about a wealth transfer from the many globally to the very few on the very top of the food chain of anywhere between $5 and $10 trillion per year, which is an incredible sum. And usury, therefore, is their main tool, but it is not their aim, it is not who they are, it is how they work, it is how they have enslaved us. And people go to work, where one of the reasons why people don't see this this enslavement is because 40% of prices that we pay are cost for capital passed on by producers in prices. So, you know, a producer needs credit to invest before he can deliver the goods to the consumer. He has to go into debt, and he pays usury over these debts. And within the supply chain, these costs for capital compound, and ultimately 40% of the prices we pay are basically cost for capital that goes directly to banks and their ultimate owners, which are the old banking families. And if you look at this, this means that even if you have no debt at all, that 40% of your disposable income is lost to usury, and this means that even if you have zero debts, that the first 2 days of the week, you are simply working for a bank, and this is the enslavement of capitalism, and this is their power base, and this is why Rothschild said what he said.
Okay, to what extent, Anthony, in your view, very generally speaking, would a completely different economy have to emerge in order to generate some healing and some freedom and our survival? I mean, how far away from the free market would we have to travel? Would there be banks in your world? What kind of general economic terrain do you foresee?
Yeah, excellent. Okay, yeah, because that's very important. In the old days, in the Catholic economy of the medieval era, I mean, we think of this as a dark era of the Dark Ages. But in fact, the common man worked for 15 working weeks per year to feed his entire family, and the Catholic Church had 200 holidays per year. And of course, people were partly enslaved by the landed aristocracy, yeah? But in terms of what they actually lost of their income to these lords, it was about 10% of their income. And this is why they simply didn't need to work so much. And the Catholic economy was severely handicapped by a lack of credit in the economy, because that's one of the key reasons for which usury was legalized in the aftermath of the medieval era. The main reason was that people were saying, hey, if there is no usury, people won't lend, and because there is no lending, there is no credit, and because there is no credit, there is no economic growth. And that is basically the narrative with which the money changers managed to get rid of usury prohibition and launch capitalism. And the great difference nowadays between the medieval era and now is that we can provide interest-free credit, because nowadays it's well known that banks create all the money that we need, and that they don't lend us any deposits, but that they create the money the moment that we go into debt. And this is done by double entry bookkeeping. It's the simplest thing in the world, and it's double entry bookkeeping has two fields in which every transaction is logged, and these fields are called debit and credit. And debit and credit means, therefore, that in double entry bookkeeping, credit is automatic. We can create all the credit that we will ever need by double entry bookkeeping. And this is actually how it's done nowadays already. But because there is a monopoly of the bookkeeping by the banks, and because they have managed to make us believe that they actually lend deposits, and because we have been sound asleep, that's the main reason, of course, they have managed to put a 5% price tag on everybody who has got debit in front of his position. And that's why we're interest slaves. But the future could be very easily transformed by just getting rid of the banks, because banking is such a vampire business. I mean, I think all the banks should be done away with forthwith and replaced with interest-free credit facilities where they create money in the same way with double entry bookkeeping, but from the understanding that it is not the bank's credit, but that it is our credit, and that it is our promise to pay that is the foundation of the money creation, and that it is our mutual acceptance of each other's promise to pay, which makes that it can be interest-free. Because that is where that is the main thing of money. It's mutual acceptance that gives it its power, and we must start to understand that we do not need a centralized system that is giving us a privilege that we can use their money. No, money is a result of our mutual acceptance, and interest-free credit is a result of our mutual acceptance. And then it can be done with by cost price, and this is a very, 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 very small step to make, basically, in terms of what is really needed. Of course, politically, it's a huge step, but practically, it's a very small step. And what this would do, this would create we would no longer have this 40% in cost for capital in prices. We would be working 20 hours a week. And we would have double living standards, because now if a normal man goes to a bank with a plan, he gets no for an answer, or if he gets a yes, he will be paying interest on the credit, which makes his many investments not feasible, not doable in common nowadays terms. But many plans would be able to be viable in an interest-free economy. And normal people would go to a bank, or an interest-free credit facility, and create their own means of survival, their own farms, their own businesses would be all under their own control. They would no longer be reliant on scarce capital, on the rich, and self-employment would be the norm. No more slavery as wage slaves. And This would see a huge relief of stress in society. It would end plutocracy overnight, because all the usury, this is very important to understand, ultimately all the usury ends up with the very richest. It's unavoidable, compounded.
So let's just look at a few particular items, if you like, from the present economic landscape. The free market. How would your free market survive your reforms?
Yeah, well, that's there is no free market. That's another very crucial thing to understand. There is no free market. Capitalism is one huge global monopoly, because the banks own each other, and this is not a conspiracy theory. This has been proven by mainstream statisticians that all the major banks own each other. And not only do they own each other, they also own by far most of all transnational corporations. So all the big guns, Exxon, Shell, BP, Facebook, Microsoft, all telecommunications, all car automotive industries, big pharma, all these massive behemoths that rule the so-called free market economy of capitalism are all owned by the same banking cartel. So there are no free markets, and free markets in theory basically can never exist, because free markets, the goal is not a free market, the goal is an equitable market where normal people can exchange goods and services with each other, and the aim is not profit. The key aim is just reasonable exchange between producing individuals, and the free market has become a whitewash for speculation, for centralization of power, for total control by capital at the cost of labor. And what we want is free enterprise for normal people, where they can start producing and that they can take it to the market and get a reasonable price for it without profiteering, without speculation, and without capitalists in between. And that's the way we want to organize things.
Okay. I have a question. You say, Anthony, that centralization is a problem, but can you see a distinction between centralization and coordination? That is to say, how might we coordinate as people who might be interested in the survival of Europeans for our larger interest as a group of people, so that we can hold up to antagonistic powers and also perhaps to facilitate projects worthy of our natural ambitions, such as space exploration. I mean, that would seem to require something akin to the centralization which you're against.
That's an excellent question, and it's all about balancing these issues. But let me take a little detour here. But what is going on now is that all our life force is being sucked up to the very top through usury, the boom-bust cycle, but also the monopolies of this transnational cartel. We have to buy these cars, which costs us a great deal of money. We are dependent on their artificially scarce energy monopoly, which is enslaving us, taking 5 to 10% of our income annually. And all these things are owned by the same people. It's all being sucked up to the very top, and they use it for their own ends. And it's pure slavery. What you are asking is, we have to work together. There are things that we need to do. We have to defend the realm. There is a common purpose as a society, as a culture. And this can be organized, but it must be organized with respect for the individual and with respect for the fact that the common man's main priority is the survival of himself and his kin, his children, his wife.
But also for different particular cultures, different ways.
Yes, okay. Of course. As white Europeans, or from a national point of view, we live together and we have a right to express ourselves as a
many
nation.
Many different ways. Yeah.
But not with a central authority that is putting a boot on our face and saying this is the direction we're going. And I believe firmly in personal conscience and the duty of each man to live his deepest truth. And I think from there on, there is a common purpose and the understanding that indeed some things need to be organized and that there must be some sort of taxation or these issues. But if we organize this in a reasonable way, maybe a man will lose 10% of his income instead of 50, 60, 70% of his income. And that's the direction we're heading. And because the money power as we know it now today is just a vampire which is leeching from our life force, what we are losing is being put into personal vaults, bank accounts, in personal projects that give us nothing. But from 10% of our income that is used in a reasonable way, in a way that we can support, like the defense of our country and these projects that you were describing, then this money can be used in a very effective way, and with far less of our income taken, we can do far more together.
Okay, fine. You mentioned earlier that the profit principle was not amenable to your way of thinking. I can't imagine an economic life without the profit principle, but perhaps you'd explain what would fit with your ideas with the treatment of profit.
Well, let me first say that my main beef is with usury, and there's the main difference between usury and profit is that usury is income through cost for capital by renting something out, for instance money, but also land. That's the widest definition of usury, and you acquire an income by owning something. So you sit on your ass and you rent this out to somebody who is then actually working for you and providing you with an income because you own something. And this is capitalism, and this is usury. And then you have profit, and profit is what results if you create something and then you market it, and then you have little added value, and you, so the market, the price for your product in terms of cost plus a little extra for yourself, and this is then profit.
Yeah.
Profit can and this is reasonable, eh? And then there is a sort of a reasonable profit, but it becomes profiteering if you create a monopoly. And you start to create artificial scarcity, and then you start policing the multitude who needs your products, as for instance with the oil cartel and the energy cartel. You start policing the populace ad infinitum because they don't have access to other forms of energy.
Yeah, so one would fall back on antitrust regulations and this sort of thing to do with
it. Regulations will be important, but there must be respect for a normal company and a man who is producing something, working with his people to create something that is of benefit to others, and then acquire a reasonable price for that, so that he can feed himself and his people and have a good life. Because,
for which you need competition.
For which you need competition, very much so, because the competition is one of the ways in a natural economy that keeps prices down, because otherwise it will be too easy for an individual to corner the market. So competition is very important.
So what we're talking about in all of this, really, at the end of the day, is balance, isn't it? Trying to find the right balance for.
Yeah.
I think we understand each other.
And the focus on production and the people, and not on the rights of capital and their tools like speculation, usury. All these things must be just done away with, because they are meaningless and they serve only the few. And we must focus on people who are actually working and creating things,
okay.
And that's what we should focus on.
Okay, I'm still on the question, the sort of major heading that I asked a little while ago about the kind of landscape that. Foresee how in the process of reform would the financialization of the current economy be handled?
The financialization is just an automatic result of usury, so an artificially scarce money, because these two things are two sides of the same coin, and this artificial scarcity of money is ultimately keeps everything scarce, because money is the gateway to products and services. So artificially scarce money creates a scarcity of everything for normal people. And this creates the financialization of the economy, because money is scarce. Businesses have to go to a bank, to the capitalist, to those owning money to be able to invest. And that's why the banks can decide what will be invested in. And this creates this dominance of finance over the productive part of the economy, which is industry, trade, the workers, etc. But if you have an interest-free credit-based money supply, or at any rate a money supply which is abundant, interest-free, low-cost, stable without inflations and deflations, then money is completely subservient to those who need to invest and who are producing and working, because then if there is a good plan and if there is a lot of energy coming from the people, then there will always be money to invest. And therefore the complete creative potential of people can really be unlocked, because what we have now with money scarcity is that people, they must survive, and they are happy to be wage slaves, so they have at least sustenance. But this has nothing to do with unlocking the real potential of people and the real creative potential of people. And all the added value is now being sucked away by finance, by banking, hedge funds, and all this bullshit. And all this must be completely done away with. And money will become far less important. The commercialization of everything will be stopped and will be turned back to a great extent. And the added value of production will remain with both the entrepreneur and the worker.
Okay.